what I like to tell people is nothing is irrevocable, especially at your age. Holy cow, you know, I was going back and forth in my 40s. You're only 20. Of course you can go try something else. And if it doesn't work out, you can come back. There is no such thing as the decision that will, you know, that you fall off a cliff at this decision, you can never get climb back up. It's not true. And I think people don't appreciate that. They still see this linear path.
Are you working in research, trying to do the best science you can?
Are you a team leader, a research assistant, postdoc, PhD student, or any other type of scientist?
Are you looking for a place where you can sit, relax, and listen to inspiring people?
Well, we have good news for you. You've just found what you're looking for.
Hi everybody, my name is Renaud Pourpre.
And I am Jonathan Weitzman.
Welcome to the Lonely Pipette,
helping scientists
do better science.
My name is Jennifer Roan, Jenny for short. I work on bacteria-host interactions at University College London, and I'm really excited to share my tips with the Lonely Pipette.
So Jennifer, or Jenny Roan, studied biology at Oberlin College in Ohio, followed by a PhD at the University of Washington in Seattle. She then moved to the Cancer Research UK Institute in London for a postdoc working on cell signaling. And then she went to Leiden in the Netherlands to work in a startup biotech company, followed by a stint in editing and publishing before returning to a Wellcome Trust research position at the MRC Lab for Molecular Cell Biology in London. In 2012, Jenny set up her own lab at the University College London, and last year she was promoted to full professor. Congratulations. Her lab works on host-pathogen interactions, antimicrobial resistance, pathogen genomic variation, and urinary tract infections. But Jenny is also a novelist, a journalist, public speaker, a science communicator, and a media expert. She coined the term lab lit to describe realistic novels featuring scientists as central characters and founded the popular website lablit.com. She also founded Science is Vital, a grassroots campaign to protect public funding of science in the UK. She's written for newspapers, including The Guardian, The Telegraph, The Times, and the BBC News. And she blogs about science at Mind the Gap. She's also the author of three published novels, Experimental Heart, The Honest Look, and Cat Zero. Jenny, thanks for coming to share your tips with the Lonely Pipette.
Thanks very much for the invitation.
Jenny, it's really an honor to have you here because you have a very particular profile, and we were so much interested in discussing with you about all that you do,
because you
do a lot. But first, as every good story, we need to introduce the character. We need a very good sight, a very good look at the origin story. So this is our first question. Can you tell us how you decided to become a scientist?
That is a good question. I grew up in a family of artists, so my mom and dad met at art school. I didn't know any scientists. I'd never talked to a scientist. I have no idea where this came into my head that I wanted to be one, except that my parents did encourage a lot of interest in nature. I spent a lot of time outside looking at stars through telescopes, catching insects in nets, sort of always thinking about science, but I don't know where it came from. I really don't. My only exposure to scientists was this really strange series of books called Danny Dunn. So Danny Dunn was an intrepid young scientist, and he had a female sidekick who was also quite nerdy. And they went on scientific adventures and solved mysteries. And I just devoured those books. I don't know where they came from, probably the library. Probably somebody pointed them out to me. And that was my only role model for science, was this fictional nerdy character in a children's book. And I do sometimes wonder where it came from, but my parents were baffled. But they encouraged me, which is great, because I was the only person in my family ever to have gone into graduate school.
So if you hadn't become a scientist, what do you think you would have become? And don't say writer. That's not an option.
I really don't know. I was interested in so many things. I went to Oberlin College, which is a university, a liberal arts university in the U.S., because I wanted to keep my options open. I knew I wanted to be a scientist, but I was interested in so many other things, particularly the humanities. And I think I went to Oberlin because I wouldn't have to shut the door completely on those other topics. I was taking ancient Greek, and I was taking advanced Spanish and linguistics, all these really archaeology, just these various other things that I was interested in, and I didn't want to close the door on science, but science was always there and did win out in the end. So I teach a lot of medical students, and I interact with a lot of doctors. I work in a hospital, so my laboratory is based in a hospital. And I have noticed that clinician scientists have a really wonderful gig, right? So they work with patients, they're on the wards, and they can get research grants and do research. But if they don't get their grant or things don't go well, they can go back to the wards and they'll get paid. So no matter what happens, they've got a secure position. And it seems as if there are a lot more opportunities, at least in the UK, for funding clinician scientists than there are just normal scientists. So in some ways, I really wish I had done a medical degree first and then gone into science, or maybe an MD, PhD. It's too late now, and I'm really fascinated by medicine. And I guess that would have been my dream career if I hadn't gone into science.
So can you think now of a moment that maybe you considered leaving science?
So I was doing my first postdoc. It was going really well. I had moved from America, from Seattle to London, to my dream postdoc. And I was so excited. And I was just thrilled to be abroad and having these adventures. And then within a couple of months, my supervisor decided to relocate to the States. And there I was. I just relocated my own life to the UK. And my home lab was moving back to California. And it was a little bit of a moment for me because I had had, I think actually it was more than a few months. I probably had been there about a year. And I was already feeling a little bit disillusioned with academia. I think it was a very competitive field. We were studying apoptosis just as apoptosis had sort of become a huge thing. And my lab had, the lab that I was working for had been at the forefront of that. And I felt this tremendous pressure, both within the lab, which was a huge, you know, there were up 20 people in this lab, and of course the surrounding competing labs, which were all over the world. And I felt this pressure, and I felt a little bit like this wasn't what I had signed up for. And I started to doubt whether I really wanted to be an academic scientist. And it kind of coupled together with the fact that I had met this really nice man, and he wanted to move to the Netherlands to further his academic career. And I had a choice, should I stay in London and be a postdoc and be a little bit disgruntled, or should I embrace this as an opportunity to maybe try something else? And that is when I saw the ad in Nature for a biotech company position, which was a research group leader position, but it was working on all the things that I already was interested in. So it was working on apoptosis, it was working on cancer, and working on viruses. Those are the three things that I had trained in and I was good at. And I thought, this must be fate. You know, I want to move to the Netherlands. There's this biotech job in the Netherlands with my name totally on it. And I thought, well, I'm just going to go for it. And I was counseled not to do this, or don't go into biotech. Back then, really? Going into biotech was quite the thing. You know, it was like going
this
over
to like
a
startup?
A startup. It was very small. And people said, oh, you really need to be careful, because once you go into biotech, you can't go back to academia. People used to say things like this. It's kind of hard to think about it now, because going into industry has cachet. You know, if you've been in industry, you're more in demand in academia. But this was, you know, a while ago. This was in the, you know, the late 1990s, and going to industry would be a black mark against you. But I decided I wanted to do it anyway, because it seemed like fate. It really seemed like this job had been written for me, and I had to just go for it. And so I did. So that was when I left academia. But the reason why I left research is because the company I joined, which had six people when I started, and about 20 people when it went bankrupt 4 years later, I was stranded in Amsterdam. I was living in Amsterdam. I was stranded. I had no job. And once I was made redundant, it's really hard to get a job once you have no employment. It's really disconcerting. If you've been on a conveyor belt your whole life, you know, you've been a success. You went to graduate school. You got a really hot postdoc. You know, you went into this really interesting biotech company, and suddenly, boom, I have no job and I'm on the dole in this foreign country. And it was really hard, because suddenly I didn't know what I was anymore. I didn't know if I was a scientist. I didn't know if I would ever get a job in science again. This is when I started writing for money, because I wasn't sure what to do. And I used to make these long, agonizing lists. Pros of staying in academia, cons of staying in academia, pros of going into
all those lists.
Staying in industry,
<Me too. laughs>
pros and cons about leaving science altogether and doing something else. And I applied for lots of jobs, because I was on job seekers allowance. You know, I was on the dole, so I had to apply for one job a week, which is quite tricky when you're a scientist. Even going to the unemployment center was an experience. Like, the lady would say, "Tell me what your profession is," and she'd go in the drop down menu, and there was nothing. Scientists did not go to job centers when they're unemployed. So it was very surreal, and I had a period of depression then. It was about half a year Amsterdam, sitting at home, trying to find a job, trying to decide what I wanted to do with my life. That's when I started writing novels. And I think maybe I would never have started writing novels if this hadn't happened to me. I don't know. But it was a real period of depression, but also, I would say, sort of renaissance in my brain, this idea that I could do other things.
And what made you realize that you could write?
I've always written. So writing's always been with me. I started writing a journal when I was, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old, and I wrote every day. I wrote all the time. I wrote stories. I even wrote little silly novels when I was little. Writing's always been a passion, and I knew I could write. So that wasn't an issue. I just didn't know I could get money for it. My first writing gig was for Science's Next Wave. It's now defunct, but it was a section of Science where people wrote about careers. And I volunteered a couple of times. And then finally, the editor said, this is ridiculous. We got to start paying you because you're just as good as our freelancers. So that's when I realized you can make money writing. Of course, I know you can't make a lot of money. Nobody can make a living off writing, I don't think. But I realized that I had a skill and a commodity, and I could, if I was going to be unemployed in the most beautiful city in the world, I might as well try to enjoy myself and earn some money and take stock and not leap into any decisions.
And then you decided to come back into academia.
No, I didn't actually. I decided, well, I wanted to. So if you were unemployed, it's quite amazing. And I did a little experiment. So before I was completely officially unemployed, I sent off lots of letters to potential academic employers and I got interviews. But the minute I became officially unemployed, I got no more interview requests. They just dried up. So I did try to get back into industry and I actually went, I'm sorry, into academia. I did try to get back into academia and industry and I didn't get any offers. So that's when I realized I had to earn a living. And this is when I started thinking about publishing. I wanted to go back to London, which I considered my spiritual home. And there were a lot of editorial jobs going. So I applied for one and I got one at Biomed Central, the open access publisher. And so, no, I didn't go straight from industry to bankruptcy back into academia. I had this 4-year stint in academic publishing.
And then you decided to come back in.
Yes. Yes, it's funny.
And now you had a job, so it was easy to get back in.
Exactly. Well, it's not easy. It's really not easy to go back into academia. And the reason why I decided to do it is I kept having this reoccurring dream where I was floating in this beautiful laboratory and against all health and safety regulations. In my dream, the windows were open and this fresh spring-like breeze was flowing through the lab. And I was trying to get into this lab through the door, but there was sort of this membrane that wouldn't let me go in. And I would wake up sort of devastated that I wasn't in a lab. And that's when I realized my subconscious was trying to tell me something, not very subtly. So I looked around and I actually hooked up with a lab head who said, you know what, they do have these really nice fellowships at Wellcome Trust. And of course, there are other funders do this now as well, that are specifically earmarked for people who want to come back into academia after a break. Most of these breaks are because of maternity, and the vast majority of people applying for these are women who've had kids. But it didn't say you had to have had a kid to qualify. So I went for it and I got it.
And what was hard about coming back?
Oh my goodness. Well, what wasn't hard? First of all, I was starting scratch in a completely new field with no previous line of research. So normally if you have a fellowship, a senior fellowship, you will have had, you know, five or six or seven years of preliminary work and publications and a reputation, but I was starting from scratch in a brand new field. I had no line of research of my own. I had to come up with one from scratch with my sponsor. That was hard. Then I didn't know anyone in the field. So I would go to these conferences and there'd be people didn't know who I was. I felt very lonely, actually. It was hard. And then I couldn't actually remember the tricks of being an academic. And I'm going to give you an example. You're going to laugh, but staying awake at seminars, you know, for some weird reason, the first six months, I go to the weekly seminar and I could not focus. I couldn't stay awake. And this is not like me at all. And I realized that's a skill that I used to have that I'd lost. And then sort of like how to do more than one experiment at once. I would go into the lab and think, okay, I remember when I was a postdoc before, I would have 6 experiments on the go. I would keep track of them all. I would have 3 different timers, 5 different lists. I couldn't do that anymore. I can only do one thing at a time. So I was very slow starting out. And then I was doing this high content screening, which is back then was really difficult. We didn't have these automated systems like Opera. And these days it's really easy. I was doing a high content reverse genetic screen using visual screening. So I would knock down 500 different genes with RNAi and then visually examine every photo. It took me years. And now you could do this whole project in 2 seconds with automatic imaging and image analysis. But I feel like that was really hard. And by the time I got to the end of my fellowship, I had, you know, a couple of papers, but nothing really earth shattering. And at that point, I was subject to this sort of expiry date thing that postdocs have, which you're not eligible for fellowships if you're X years from your PhD. That starts to bite when you become a senior postdoc. Even if you take into account my career break and everything else, I was reaching the end of the line for fellowships. So it was a sort of an existential time. Yet again, here I am coming to the end and not knowing what was coming next. So again, I had to assess, do I really want to stay in academia or do I want to do something else?
Just to precise something, were there a time where you had to manage both of them, the publishing and starting to work in the lab, or did you manage to separate both
of
them?
No, I did have to write the fellowship while I was still employed. But, you know, publishing, it's a nice gig. It's cushy. You know, it's 9 to 5, very well paid, very stable. And I could go home and work on my fellowship without having any problems. Okay. So no, there wasn't. It was nice. It was a nice clean break.
Okay. Right. So now you're back in the lab. you've learned, you had mentors. You became also probably a mentor and everything. So we in this podcast, we love to explore this. And since you have many experiences in different fields, what mentoring practice do you keep in your own lab that you have learned from your mentor?
Yeah, I think I learned a lot from people who weren't good mentors. I had a lot of interaction with senior staff, people who were my age, but were way ahead of me because I'd taken this break. Not only did I have the 4-year break, but I had the industry break as well. So people were professors now that I was a postdoc with, for example. And I got a lot of unsolicited advice from some of these people saying things like, oh, well, if you haven't made it by now, you're never going to make it. And you should just give up and go, you know, you're really interested in writing and all these fun other things you do. Why don't you just focus on that? I got a lot of that and it wasn't helpful because that's not what I wanted to hear. And that's not what I believed. And I think that kind of advice is damaging because when I hear advice like that, I just get angry and want to prove people wrong. But I know lots of people who might take advice like that to heart. So I think if you are in a position of authority and people look up to you, and they come to you for your advice, you shouldn't be so negative, even if in your heart of hearts, you know that this person maybe isn't cut out for this or that. There are ways of doing it. And also, you can have faith in people that they have more abilities than you might think they do. So because I got so much bad advice, whenever I give advice, I'm really super careful to consider the person and their situation, and also to consider the fact that people can change. They can do different things. They do have powers, they can pull from within and do amazing things. And maybe it's not obvious right now, but they have potential. So I really take that responsibility very seriously. Every word that comes out of my mouth, somebody might literally be thinking, that's gospel. You know, if she says I can't do it, I can't do it. So because I know this, everything I say is really careful. I try not to be negative. I try to raise people up and be as encouraging as possible. I do say, you know, I'm not sure this is going to work out for you, but I think you should try. If you think you can do it, I believe in you. But you should keep in mind that it might not be easy, and at some point you might have to change your plan. So that's kind of how I do it. I don't want to just be all, oh, positive, positive, positive. You can do whatever you want, because that's not true. We all know that's not true. But I try to hedge it a little, saying, I really want you to go for it, but just keep in the back of your mind that you might need a plan B. And by the way, do you want to talk to me about that plan B? And let's get a few plan B and plan C in place in case your dream plan A doesn't work out.
Mm-hmm. So where do you think all these myths come from, that you can't go to industry and come back, that once you're in publishing, you know, you can't come back, that if you haven't made it, but if you haven't got your Nature paper by a certain age, you're done?
It's hard to say. I mean, I'm from the American system, which you probably know it's kind of different than the European system in that it's really terrifying in a way. You know, there was in the old days, maybe still is, this impression that there's one way to do science, and that is you jump on your bandwagon, you follow through this conveyor belt, and you publish as many high impact papers as you can, and you don't get distracted by anything else, and then you'll get to be a professor. I think this worldview is how it used to be. And I think somewhere around the 90s, early 2000s, this started to change, but the old guard hadn't really noticed, and they were still giving the bad advice. I think now it has changed quite a bit. You will never hear somebody saying, oh, it's not good. It's not a good idea to have an internship in industry. In fact, you can get grants to have an internship in industry. It's seen as a good thing. People say, you know, the public sector is a really promising place to go if you don't want to do academics. Please do consider it. You know, let's invite some people to our department to speak about alternative careers. You never could have done that in my day. You know, when I was a graduate student, you would never have somebody coming in and saying, oh, let's talk about careers in science publishing. Let's talk about careers even in industry. You wouldn't talk about it. It was verboten. It was a failure if you didn't do anything but become a clone of your supervisor, which is a ridiculous thing because your supervisor would spawn 60 to 100 apprentices, but only one replacement. You know, there's only one replacement for the prof. What are those other 99 people going to do? So I don't know. I think things have changed for the better. And I think these stigmas are gone. And I think you can now go from one thing to another, and it's even encouraged, which is good.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, that's a good message. Like, let's allow ourselves to explore this, because maybe this is something we are not seeing enough. We say that now this is open, and let's tell people that you are allowed to explore those paths or alternatives or non-linear career.
Yeah, I just say that one of the things that I encounter all the time from young people is, you know, they say, Dr. Roan, I really want to try science publishing, but if I do this, you know, that's it. I've chosen science publishing, and that's irrevocable. And what I like to tell people is nothing is irrevocable, especially at your age. Holy cow, you know, I was going back and forth in my 40s. You're only 20. Of course you can go try something else. And if it doesn't work out, you can come back. There is no such thing as the decision that will, you know, that you fall off a cliff at this decision, you can never get climb back up. It's not true. And I think people don't appreciate that. They still see this linear path. Maybe they're not actively discouraged from taking other paths, but they still in their mind think there's only one way to be a scientist. And I think it's really important for mentors to dissuade them of that. And also that departments do really good things like invite in outside speakers from other careers to talk to students and give them an idea that there are other things to do besides, you know, that very long shot of becoming an academic professor. There's not enough space for everybody to do that. So we might as well tell people about the alternatives.
So there are lots of choices along the way. And you're right, careers are non-linear. I'm a big believer in that. But also scientific paths may be linear or non-linear. So we saw somewhere that you were described as, I think it's an article in The Guardian that said she fights badass bugs for a living. So what made you become a badass bug fighter?
And like badass bug fighter.
Yeah. How have you chosen what you work on? Because you've also worked on lots of different things, and I get the sense it's not very linear either.
No, that's a good point. I mean, it's very, when I'm building my CV or a personal statement, I spin a narrative in a way. I shouldn't be telling my tricks out loud, but you know, I spin a narrative. You know, I make my career sound as if it's all coherent and there was a master plan. But actually, there wasn't a master plan. I did start out in infectious diseases. Of course, I had a PhD in microbiology, and I was trained in virology, subset of microbiology. So my original love always was pathogens, and I got sort of swayed by cancer because I was working on viruses that cause cancer, and I got very sidetracked by how interesting cancer was, and that dictated my career choices for the next few years, working on cell death and signaling and going into the biotech company. That dictated all my choices. So going into cell signaling and apoptosis in cancer cells, and then the biotech company where I was working on a new cancer treatment. And then when I re-entered academia, working on actin and cell shape, which is also with a cancer spin. But I got swayed back to infectious diseases kind of by accident. As I mentioned, I was at the end of my fellowship. I wasn't sure how I was going to stay in academia. It was quite a difficult time for me. And that is when I went to a cocktail party that was organized by my university. It was one of these parties where, oh, let's put physicists and engineers and biologists in the same room and see what happens. I did not want to go to this thing. It was Friday nights. I was tired. And my supervisor said, go on, you might meet someone interesting. And I didn't want to go, but I went. And in that room, I was sitting at the same table as a clinician and an engineer. It sounds like a joke. A clinician, an engineer, and a biologist walk into a party. So I was with an engineer, a material scientist, a clinician, and myself. We were all on the same table. And it was you couldn't make this thing up. So you had the material scientists and the engineers were saying, we've got this interesting technology, but we don't have a disease to apply it to. And the clinician says, we've got this clinical problem and we don't have any drugs for it. And I said, I'm a cell biologist and I'm looking for an interesting project to apply my interest in infectious disease. And the three of us, sort of, four of us suddenly just stopped and looked at each other. And when the movie comes out, I want to know who's going to play me. It was really a surreal moment when we realized that the four of us could hook up and try to do something interesting, and each of them filling in a gap that the other one was missing. And the rest is history. And I think this just underscores something I always tell my trainees as well, which is, do not ever turn away from the opportunity to network. No matter how boring or tired you are or shy you are, you never know what kind of opportunity is going to drop in your lap if you go and mingle with people, because that is where everything happens. And I'm living proof of that. If I hadn't gone to that party, I never would have met these people, and I wouldn't have been able to cobble together my next academic position. I would have been on the dole again, and maybe I would be working in publishing. I don't know. But that was really important. And I tell my trainees, especially the shy ones, you can't just go to a meeting and just huddle with your lab mates. You've got to go out and talk to people. Identify the big people in the room that you really want to know more about, and just go stand next to them. Break into the circle when there's a group of people talking. It's so hard, but that skill is essential.
So with all your writing activities that you have and that we are going to talk about later, how do you manage to keep the lab running? How do you manage this time?
I'm laughing because it's not easy. Also, I have a child now. I have what's known euphemistically as a geriatric mother. I gave birth in my mid-40s. So my child is 8 years old now. Thank you. He's eight. So he's actually coming to the point now where he's self-cleaning, and you can set him up doing something and he doesn't need much attention. But it was really hard. So I was, when my fellowship was coming to an end, just after that is when I got pregnant. I was trying to write fellowships while I was on maternity leave. It was really hard. And I think that was the single most difficult thing that I've had to deal with is being a mother and keeping everything going. Now that he's, now that he's self-sufficient and grown up a bit, I'm actually doing really well. I've got a lot of teaching. I've got a lot of research, and I'm working with a biotech company, and I'm trying to keep some semblance of science communication going. And these are four different hats. I just wear them at the right place at the right time. The recipe is, I don't work very long hours on academia. I work, maybe 50 hours. It depends, things ebb and flow, but I don't work all weekend in academia. I don't work all night in academia unless I've got a grant deadline or something. I do carve out time for myself and for my writing, but the writing's definitely suffered. I haven't done a huge amount of writing for the past few years, as people may have noticed. This is because becoming a professor and having more responsibilities with teaching, it's taken its toll and it's difficult. But I know from the past that my writing goes in cycles. There was a 7-year gap between my second and my third novel, and I know I will get back to it eventually. And the idea is not to beat yourself up if you're not doing everything at once. Maybe one of your hobbies or your passions has to be on the sideline for a while. Once I get more control over my academic routine, I think I will have more time for other things.
So let's talk about one of your passions is writing. So you write about the research world and the research culture. Can you tell us more about this word lab lit and how you got started on this adventure?
Yeah, so this all started in graduate school when I read my first novel about scientists, which was Cantor's Dilemma by Carl Gerassi. That was the first book I'd ever read where a scientist was the central character and they were just doing science. And it's funny, it had never, I guess, thinking back to those books I read as a child, the Danny Dunn series, actually that was lab lit, but I hadn't really appreciated it. And between Danny Dunn, when I was 8 years old, and reading Carl Gerassi's novel, it never really occurred to me that you couldn't see much science in fiction. There wasn't a big presence there. And that struck me as really odd. I suddenly thought, this is crazy. There are millions of scientists on this planet doing really important work. And not only is it important, but it's quite interesting. It's fun. Maybe it's a difficult topic, but it's also really crucial. Science underpins everything we do. Why aren't there more stories about it? And I got obsessed by this. Where are all the lab lit novels? I called it lab lit because at the time, chick lit was big. And it was sort of a genre. It was a paperback with a pink cover and a girl with a shopping bag. There were millions of chick lit novels out there. And I thought, well, how about let's sort of rebrand this idea. And I called it lab lit, which is short for laboratory literature.
But this is different from science fiction, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so laboratory literature, it's different because lab lit also in the sense of illumination, illuminating this hidden world. And yes, so science fiction, you don't have to have a scientist in a science fiction story, do you? I mean, many science fiction stories have nothing to do with science. They're just set in a future or speculative world. So the idea behind lab lit is it's realistic fiction about scientists as a profession, science as a profession. And it has to be kind of central. Not like, you know, in Friends, Ross is apparently a scientist, but you would never know it if you watch Friends. Ross's being a scientist is irrelevant to the plot. So lab lit involves a scientist doing something sciencey as part of the plot. But there's a huge range. You can interpret that a lot of different ways. And that is the reason I started the website, is because I wanted to raise awareness of this appalling lack of lab lit in the literature world. And if you look on the list that I keep on my website, lablit.com, you'll see there's only about 300 novels ever written with scientists as central characters, which seems really shocking. 300! You know how many novels are written every year? You know, millions of them. And there's only ever written ever about 300. It's probably more than that. I've probably missed a few. But after a very long time, almost 20 years now, of chasing down leads and looking through libraries and scanning online, I've never found more than 300 or 400.
So you mentioned Carl Gerasi. I just wondered whether, do you think the best lab lit is written by scientists, or actually scientists don't make very good authors of fiction?
So a while back, I published a piece in Nature where I actually plotted out in a graph lab lit novels as a function of being written by a scientist or a non-scientist. And first of all, I plotted that there had been a really interesting increase in lab lit over the past 20 years, probably coinciding with the whole geek chic movement and science becoming cool and trendy. But about 50% of those books were written by non-scientists, and about 50% were written by scientists. And I have to say, I think...
Which ones are better?
Yeah, I think the ones that are written by non-scientists are probably better, in that, well, a lot of these authors are, you know, professional authors. They're literary people. They know about novels as a craft. I don't want to diss anyone who's written a novel, least of all myself. But I think scientists can sometimes struggle with portraying science in a way that can be understandable. But then so can non-scientists. It's really tricky. Mm. It's a really tricky art. The art of conveying complex information in a way that doesn't frighten people who have been conditioned all their lives to be afraid or to hate science. Not an easy gig. So there are some brilliant lab lit novels written by actual scientists, and there's some real bad ones.
What are some of your favorites?
Well, one of my favorite lab lit novels by a non-scientist is Flight Behavior by Barbara Kingsolver. Barbara Kingsolver is an amazing novelist. I don't know if you've read her stuff, but she's just absolutely beautiful. And the reason why it works so well is because her main character is a woman who knows nothing about scientists, and she's living in rural, I think Tennessee, or I can't remember, Tennessee or Alabama. And she's uneducated, but she's very smart. And a bunch of scientists move in to start studying the local fauna in her woods. And she sees the scientists and the scientific practice through the eyes of a complete outsider, but just done in a beautiful way where it's all laid bare, but from a perspective of someone who knows nothing. And that's kind of the value of being a non-scientist. You can really give that perspective that most readers will relate to.
So what's the value of one lab lit written by a scientist like you, for example? Like, is there some important picture that you want to draw out of it? Or,
you know, there's this adage, you should write what you know. And I think unless you've actually been a scientist, it's very difficult to put yourself in the shoes of a modern professional scientist. I mean, people have done really well. So Allegra Goodman wrote a great book called Intuition, where you might have guessed that she was a scientist because it was done so well.
Her husband's a scientist, right?
Yeah, her husband. Yeah. And she shadowed
her sister and her brother-in-law.
Yeah, and she shadowed laboratory scientists for weeks, I think, at the MIT or something. Yeah. So she really did her research. And yes, she had the advantage of having relatives. So, but if you don't have that advantage, or there's only so much that research can tell you, if you haven't lived that life, I think it's very difficult to explain to outsiders. And that's kind of what I wanted to do with my first novel, where the main character is a workaholic. And this was sort of from although it's set in London, this was from the American perspective of postdocs who basically do nothing else. I was coming into the lab at midnight, and I would go clubbing and then come in at 3 a.m. I remember I once set off the alarms in the animal house because I'd come in at 3 a.m. without my ID and I was dressed up like a goth, because that's what you, when you went clubbing in Seattle in the, you know, in grunge era, I look like an animal rights activist, I'm sure. I just got arrested. So, I mean, I was doing crazy things like that. I was working on Christmas Day. I was interested in that mentality. And I know other professions also have workaholics, but I think there's something particular about this, the phenotype of being a scientist and just being so driven, especially when you're young and you can pull it off. And I was interested in that. And I think that when you live this life, things occur to you that might not occur to outsiders. And that's why it's beneficial to write about it, because only you can tell that story in a way.
So is there important messages that you tried with some of your... I know that I didn't had the chance to read all your novels, of course. But I've seen that some of them you describe also the realities of lab life. And was that one of the first intention you put into these kind of stories, to share these realities? Or
yeah, so I don't want to cheerlead for science. And I have got criticized by some scientists saying, "Oh, you portrayed a scientist negatively. That's very irresponsible of you." And I say, "Why? Scientists do bad things sometimes. Scientists are not perfect." And I think the problem that science gets into is that we have a complete public relations problem. People think of us a particular way, and then we just act and reinforce that stereotype. You know, the white-coated, aloof, completely impartial, machine-like brain that where emotion has no place in anything. And these stereotypes are harmful, because people start to view scientists as being otherworldly, not among us, you know, not one of us. And so why should we trust this person who's so scary? And my mission was to shed a light, lab lit, so illuminate the lab as a place where human beings are involved in a sort of a messy process that leads to truths with a small t, but not necessarily truths with a large t. And I think if people start to view scientists as human beings who have love lives and issues and maybe ethical quandaries and are just maybe the same as them, they might then find us more sympathetic and trustworthy. So when we say things like, "This COVID vaccine is safe," they might believe us, instead of saying, "Oh, well, you would say that. You're some pharma, you know, someone paid by the pharma industry to say bad things, and you've got magnetic chips in there and you're going to put us all into concentration camps." I mean, you can't really reason with people like that. But I do think there's a kernel of truth that if your messenger is not trustworthy, mm-hmm. then you're not going to trust the message either. So part of my passion is not to impart scientific facts and figures, although I do that a little bit as part of the plot. The underlying, maybe subversive thing that I'm trying to do is to just show lab life as what it's really like, and to show scientists as human beings and for all their flaws. You know, these aren't perfect people. None of us are perfect, but our heart's in the right place, usually. And we're just trying to help people. And I think that's what I'm trying to do with my novels.
Where do you get the ideas for the plots and the characters? Are they based on
postdocs?
Well, they are based on people I know. So after I wrote my first novel,
Everyone said that's me.
Well, it was quite funny. There's a PhD supervisor in the novel, and my PhD supervisor emailed me and she said, "That's me, isn't it?" I said, "Yeah, essentially." But most of my characters are mixtures of myself and other people that I have encountered, and they're not one person, with the exception of that character, who was very much based on my PhD supervisor. They're just snippets and flashes of color and character that I've sort of stolen and appropriated from all of my experiences. Some of them are completely fictional. There were things that I maybe wanted to be. For example, in my third novel, the main character is somebody I wish I was, and I'm not. And I've always wanted to be like that, and I never will be. So I found that as an interesting, you know, study. Can I write a story about this persona that I'm not?
Do you have advice for young researchers, postdocs, who want to start writing fiction?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to be a writer, you've got to write a lot. And I think you should start by keeping a blog. Maybe blogs are a bit old-fashioned now, aren't they? I don't know. Is blogging a dying art? I don't know. Keep a blog. You need to get in the habit of writing and experimenting with words. And you have to read a lot as well. I think it's really important to read. So you read things that you like reading, and maybe read things you've never read before, and try to get experience with other ways of writing. But the bottom line is, a real writer will want to write and will have to write. And if, but there can be this block at the beginning where you don't know where to start. And so my suggestion is just start writing. Maybe blog, but don't put it live. Just blog for yourself or keep a journal until you feel comfortable, and then start putting it out there and seeing what people think and getting advice. I always give my novels to loads of different people, especially non-scientists, because I need to gauge, am I hitting the right level here? Am I losing everyone, or am I being patronizing? Please let me know. So that's what I do. But if you're just starting out, I mean, my advice is just to write. Just start writing and see where it takes you.
You said that sometimes you explore models or characters that you have wished you would have wished to be or to which this kind of experience do you think it has influenced you later in your lab work? Like, did you at the end tried to implement in your real life something that you wrote before?
Actually, now that you mention it, I think that is true. I think especially in that third novel, that character who was a very, you know, very hot, sort of really smart, really outgoing professor. I wanted to be more outgoing. I wanted to be the kind of person who people wanted to talk to at meetings. I wanted to be that person. I didn't know if I ever would be. And sometimes I am inspired by that character thinking, well, I should be more like her. You know, I should be less shy and I should put myself out more. And yes, you do get influenced by these characters because they become real. When you're writing a novel, it is really scary. They inhabit your brain. They wake you up in the middle of the night, and they become like real people. You can fall in love with them in a way, and it's like falling in love. You're in this spell until the novel's over, and then you're devastated because it's like you've broken up with the love of your life. It's really weird, and I never thought that would happen to me, and I don't know if I'll ever recapture that. It happened 3 times, but I don't know if I can get it back. But it's an amazing feeling, the creativity that goes on. And it's all subconscious, and I don't understand any of it.
So I've done a lot of non-academic writing and found that it's very liberating because it doesn't have all the constraints of very strict scientific writing where you have to be careful with every word and every sentence, every citation. Have you found that your literature, your fiction writing has influenced the way you write science and the way you write grants? I feel there isn't enough narrative in scientific writing. Have you found that what you've learned from fiction writing actually has impacted the way you write grants and tell scientific stories?
Absolutely. And I teach this to my students now, the importance of narrative. There's a big conversation going on, of course, about retrospective narratives. And of course, papers are not, you never do the experiments in the order in which they're presented, but you present experiments in a logical order that makes narrative sense. And we all do it. It makes a better story. It's more logical. It hangs together. And definitely writing fiction has helped me write my papers and grants, although I don't want to say that I'm writing fictional. Obviously, my grants and papers are not fictional, but that whole, you know, first we did this, and then we showed this. And then following on from that, we decided to do this. And that, I actually encourage my trainees to write in first person, you know, we, and not in passive voice, to tell it like a story, to lead people along, tell them why you're doing the experiment, what happened, and then what conclusion they should take away. And then on to the next experiment. And I think that way of writing is really useful.
Do you think one of your writing has helped you to shape a science model for real or to help you with your thoughts?
Not in so many words, but I would say that my third novel, Cat Zero, which is about a plague, it's about an epidemic. I talked to a lot of people when I was writing. This was way before COVID and way before epidemiology was something that everybody did. And I went and talked to Bill Hannage, who is he works at the Harvard Chan, very well-known epidemiologist. And I chatted to him about this cat plague, this fictional cat plague, and how to make it more realistic. And I incorporated a lot of, I used the word R-naught in the novel and all these sorts of things that at the time were just gobbledygook. But now it's sort of a household thing, all this epidemiology stuff. It's quite interesting how Cat Zero kind of mirrored a little bit about COVID, including the fact that it involves a cat strain that arose in Kent, which is where the alpha strain of COVID arose, which is just down the road from me in Gravesend. And it was fun.
Jumps from cats to humans as well, right?
Yeah. So I it's funny that a lot of the tropes in that novel kind of are a bit COVID-y, although it was way before COVID. So I haven't enjoyed watching COVID unfold, but it's made me laugh a few times at some of the similarities. And yeah.
We're worried about what your next book is about. The prophetic.
Aliens. Well, I don't know. I think it has helped me to examine my practices So not from a scientific point of view, but from a more behavioral point of view. Writing the book about the workaholic made me realize that I was working too hard and that wasn't good. The second novel was about it, working in industry, which very much mirrored some of my own experiences. And it made me see the role of, you know, sort of the profit motive of industry in a new light. Sort of that we always think about the pressures of publishing. You know, they say that scientific fraud is caused mostly by pressures in publishing, people needing sell papers or whatever. But I think the financial incentive as well is quite important. So I hadn't really thought about that before I wrote the novel. And every time I write a novel, it makes me think more about, so it doesn't inform my science, it informs my view of the culture.
Okay, that's great. So thank you for sharing all that. We're going to take a short break. And after the break, we'll come back and hear more about behind the author and the scientist.
Hey folks, don't run away. You're listening to The Lonely Pipette with Renaud Pourpre and Jonathan Weissman, where our goal is to help scientists do better science.
If you're enjoying the show and you want to learn more, you can follow us on Twitter at Lonely Pipette. And please share the podcast with your friends.
If you don't want to miss any of our future episodes, you can subscribe to our mailing list and join our community. Click on the subscription link on our Twitter account.
It's as simple as that. Take a few moments to get more tips from the Lonely Pipette. So welcome back. The Lonely Pipette is talking today with Jenny Roan. And so Jenny, you told us you're a scientist and a writer and a mother, and sounds like a hectic life. Do you have a morning routine? What is the day? How does the day start?
This is going to sound really cliche, but ever since lockdown, I started to do morning exercise. And it started out because I was doing it with my son, but I've always wanted to be more in shape than I am. And when I was commuting, so I commute to central London, it takes a long time, it takes an hour and a half. And I never had time to do exercising, and I never did it very often. And during lockdown, I got into these habits of exercising every day. And another thing that I do is when I drop my son off from school, I would take the long way home. I climb up this big hill that overlooks the Thames River, and I just take in the morning and get fresh air. And I never, ever would have given myself time to do that if it hadn't been for the pandemic. So even though I'm going back to work now, I just basically get up earlier so that I can squeeze in my exercise and my walk. And I think it's made a huge difference, because in the old days, I would leave the house in darkness, in the winter especially. I'd leave the house when it was dark. I'd leave the lab when it was dark. There were no windows in the lab. I would never see the sun. And now every day, without fail, I get some fresh air and I see the sun, if there is any sun, which isn't very often this time of year. And I think that's made a big difference to my outlook.
When is the writing practice? The writers always say you have to write every day.
Yeah, I write on the train. I write with a pen still when I'm writing in my journal, and I write every day, whether that's on the train or the underground or snatching a moment here when I'm waiting for someone to come to a meeting who's late. So I always carry that around with me. For more formal writing on the computer, I do it in the evenings or weekends, not regularly, but every week, but not at a regular time.
What is something about Jennifer Roan that people would be surprised to discover?
I don't know. I think it could be that I'm actually an avid musician and singer. And for a while I was in this covers band, we played sort of covers of well-known rock tunes, but in a different style. So we did a punk version of The Girl from Ipanema, for example. and we used to put on these huge parties for our friends that cost, you know, hundreds of pounds of our own money to put on. We weren't making money, we were paying to play. And it was really good fun. I've always been a very keen musician, and I miss having time to do that more. But I think most people don't realize that I sort of am a rock chick, part-time rock chick.
You said that the COVID crisis helped you to install a new routine. But is there in the last 2 years something else, I don't know, new belief, behavior, or another habit that really has improved your life?
I think because I was working from home for so long, and I still work from home occasionally, I think I've rediscovered the ability of working from home. So in the old days, I would go in every day, no matter what. Even if I had a huge grant deadline, I would commute to work and commute home and waste all that time. And now I realize that even though I'm back at work now, there's nothing stopping me from saying, I'm going to stay home on Friday and just write my grant. I'm not actually going to go into the lab at all. And it sounds so obvious now, but before
it's like
pandemic,
a discovery, yeah?
Oh my God, I could actually work from home 2 days a week if I wanted to. And the sky's not going to fall in. I think part of it's becoming a professor and realizing that I'm no longer feel like I have a boss. My department head's probably listening to this. Sorry, Alan. No, I mean, I feel like nobody's watching the clock. Nobody's worried if I'm not showing my face every single day. And that's been liberating because I have found that working from home is much more conducive to serious thought. Like if I have to do admin or emails or teaching prep, I'm fine to be in the lab. But if I have to really think about a paper or a grant, I need peace and quiet. And I don't need people knocking on my office door every 2 seconds. I need to be alone. And that's been a revelation. And also I'm eating better because if I'm working from home, I can make a nice lunch, nice and healthy. I don't snack a lot. There's not all that food in the lab that the postdocs bring in. I feel like I'm eating better. I'm sleeping better. I'm getting exercise. I'm getting fresh air. Everything just feels better than it used to.
We were wondering whether how you deal with stress, your fiction writing, is that a way of relieving stress or do you have some other ways of relieving stress?
Well, writing for sure helps relieve stress. And this would be more my journal. So I keep this daily journal where if something goes horribly wrong and things go really wrong for me all the time, but if I write them down, I feel like I have more control over it. And I sometimes realize in writing things down that it's not as bad as I thought.
What does that look like? Is it prose? You just write about your day and...
Yeah. I mean, I won't give anything away, but this is... I can show you here on camera. Okay. I know you can hear. So I'm showing the gentleman.
I have one as well.
It's just it's a small notebook. I write, you know, prose, and then I also keep lab lists. And it's basically like a scrapbook and a journal. And I write longhand and cursive with terrible handwriting. The older I get, the harder it is for me to read my own handwriting. But that is my stress relief. Writing fiction is a bit more stressful, I think, because I find there is this tension and you're getting swept up in the story and it's not relaxing at all. And you also feel the pressure, you know, especially when things aren't moving and you feel like you're blocked or whatever.
Yeah. Do you have writer's block and how do you deal with that?
I'd like to argue that the last 5 years of my life, I probably have had a bit of writer's block and that I haven't written seriously. I write short stories now and I write blogs and I write in my journal, but I haven't been able to get a new novel to catch fire. I have tried. I've got a few chapters, but for some reason, I think it's just the wrong time of life. I think it's, you know, I've had my kid. I'm very busy. Maybe I am blocked for novel writing, but I'm not blocked for any other kind of writing, interestingly.
Outside of science, do you have an individual or celebrity or anyone that has inspired you for your life and your work?
This is so hard. You should have asked me this one in advance so I could have thought about it. I really love John William Waterhouse, who's one of these Pre-Raphaelite painters from the 1800s. He writes, he paints these beautiful scenes of mythology and femme fatales and Greek stories. And I saw his work for real when I was living in Amsterdam, and there was an exhibit called Fatale Frauen, or fatal women, femme fatale, essentially, in Groningen. And I went to see it and I was just blown away because I was a little bit depressed at the time, as I mentioned. And there was something about his paintings that just resonated with my sense of not only being sad and adrift, but also being incredibly creative because the novels were just pouring out of me like magic. I didn't know where they were coming from. And when I saw those paintings, I thought, this kind of, I feel an affinity with this painter. Didn't do that many paintings. I mean, there's not much to look at, but I feel like I love art and I admire art. My parents were artists. It's deeply mysterious. I mean, I can draw a little bit. I'm not bad. But to have the gift of visualizing things from your mind, like I can take things from my mind and put them on paper in words. But to be able to do that visually, I think is just an amazing thing. So I admire all sorts of artists, but particularly that one. And I'd say that was probably most of my inspiration comes from art. John William Waterhouse.
Okay.
You probably recognize some, like the Lady of Shalott. He's got, you know, there's lots of pictures of Arthurian legend and Greek myths. Look him up. Beautiful stuff. Beautiful stuff.
Will do.
Yeah.
What is a success that you're particularly proud of, do you think?
Well, I'm really, aside from the fact that I published 3 novels, which I never thought I would do, scientifically, I think my biggest success is the stuff I'm working on now, where we're trying to get a new cure for urinary tract infection commercialized and out there for patients. And we've been working on this for 10 years. This was the original cocktail party story I told you about. This is culminating, hopefully very soon, hopefully next year, in its first clinical trial. And urinary tract infection patients are primarily women. Women's health has been horrifically neglected by scientists and doctors throughout the ages. And many thousands, if not millions, of women are suffering needlessly because nobody cares enough to do research into urinary tract infection. It's not just some pesky, superficial problem. It can ruin people's lives. It can kill people. It's a really serious problem, especially with antibiotics not working so well anymore. And we wanted to come up with a way to cure the people who weren't cured by conventional antibiotics. There's an awful lot of those people out there. So I can't say that it's going to work. I mean, everything looks good. The preclinical stuff looked good. Heading into clinical trials, I really hope it works. But even if it doesn't work, I'm really proud of the fact that we got it this far. And it's been a privilege for me to interact with sort of the commercial side of things. When I was working in the biotech company, it wasn't really my stuff. I mean, I was working at the company, but I didn't come up with the idea. And it didn't feel like my baby. But this feels like my baby. Obviously, I'm sure I've collaborated. It's a group effort, but it's really come from a lot of work that I've done personally with my own hands. And the thought of that becoming an actual drug that people can take just blows my mind. And realistically, it may never get that far, but just the fact that I've come this far is very exciting. And I'm really proud of that.
Good. I hope it works. Do you have a sentence written on the door of your lab? And if you don't, what would it be? What would it be, like a one sentence piece of advice?
No decision is a wrong decision.
Is that written on your lab?
It isn't, but it should be. And this is what I tell all my trainees. There is no, if you're agonizing over this decision, oh, I've got five different offers and I don't know which one to take. Any one you take will be the right one.
I always say the best decision is the one you took. Yeah.
Similar.
Yeah.
It's amazing how people don't consider that. I think they really think there's a right answer and a wrong answer for career choices. And it's, in my experience, whatever path you take, there'll be a parallel you that took other paths, but you'll never know that parallel you. And you'll never find out that parallel you is earning twice as much money and is much happier. You can never know.
Yeah.
So why even worry about it? Just go down a path and make the best of it.
Yeah. And people sometimes struggle so much about that. Like, I know that I've literally spent hours sometimes not be able to decide just because I was like, okay, if I take this solution, this will be my future. But if I take this one, this will be. And at the end,
But in some ways, that's true. That's the other scary thing is I don't want to belittle it because, you know, if you have three choices, yes, it's going to change the course of your life, whichever one you choose. And it isn't an easy decision. And when you're in the midst of that, it doesn't help for me to say, oh, just pick one. Flip a coin. That's not how it works. But, you know, making a list of pros and cons that we were talking about, weighing all the evidence and then just choosing one and not looking back and not regretting.
Okay, yeah.
That's important.
Great. So if you do put this sentence on your door, please send us a picture. We would love to share it.
I think I might.
Is there a book or a movie that you would recommend to help scientists in their crazy life?
A tough question. Book or movie?
We are in the section of the tough questions.
I always recommend Lablet because it's quite fun to read about scientists and to feel like you're your profession could be the star. You know, you could be the hero of a story. I feel like when I was reading stories of scientists doing amazing things, it made me feel more worthwhile, like what I was doing was important. And you can argue, though, God, I think about science all day. I don't want to go home and read a novel about science. But in some ways, I found it really helpful to see other people's viewpoints of scientists and seeing your own world through other people's eyes. I think that's really useful.
Actually, it makes me think of a movie, a recent movie. Maybe you had the chance to watch Don't Look Up.
I thought it was great. I do not understand why everybody was so negative about this movie. I thought it was fabulous. You know, it starts out with a classic lab lit scene where the disgruntled, tired PhD student clumps up to her telescope and she's listening to music in the headphones. She's not really that bothered. And then she makes the discovery and she claps her hands together and gasps like a little girl. And I thought, that is science. That is perfectly encapsulated what it's like to be a scientist. And I thought the whole movie was and obviously it was satire, but it was really affecting. And for the next week or two after watching the film, I was walking around in my morning walks going, oh my God, thank God. The planet's still here and we're not about to die. It had a huge effect on me. And maybe that wasn't the intention. And I guess I wasn't the target audience, but.
Who's the target audience for your books?
Very much non-scientists. I mean, I want to write in a way that doesn't alienate my scientist colleagues, nobody wants to see their field belittled or their science dumbed down too much. But I have to cater to the non-scientists. So sometimes I have to simplify concepts. I make stuff up, which I love. Like, you know, you were talking about writing and the constraints of fiction, not having the constraints of nonfiction. I love that I can just make up science. I don't have to go do research. And I've often been asked to write nonfiction popular science books. And I just thought, that's too much like hard work. I'd have to do research and get all my facts straight. Fiction is brilliant because you can just write about whatever. But I do write for the non-scientist audience. And apparently I've got a very large fan base of women of a certain age, of about 50 or 60, who just, they're not scientists, they're interested in that world. And I think that's great.
can you think of a time when things didn't go as planned and how did you get back on track?
Well, I mean, that clearly the biotech company going bankrupt was a complete disaster on every measurable front. It was a really high power thing. It was, you know, it was a small company, but we were really excited. We were convinced we had a cure for cancer. I'm still convinced it would have worked. And to suddenly go from that to nothing. Actually, it wasn't sudden. It was this long, slow death that took 3 or 4 months of people getting laid off gradually. I was the last one there, and there was no party for me because I was the last one. I just boxed up my things and went home, and it was hard. And then being on the dole, not having a job, it's so embarrassing. Now you meet people at parties, say, "What do you do?" Actually, I don't have a job. I never thought those words would come out of my mouth. And what I did is I turned that misfortune around, and I reinvented myself as a writer and then later as an editor in publishing. And that was just so character forming. But at the time, it was awful. It was really awful. And I think getting through that, I could get through anything. This is why I tell people that even if it seems like you've made the worst decision in the world, there I was saying, oh my God, if I hadn't left academia, I wouldn't be in this situation. Mm-hmm. I must have made the wrong choice. But then if I hadn't, I wouldn't have picked up writing. I wouldn't have started this other course, and I wouldn't have picked up all these other skills. And, you know, I wouldn't have lived in another country. There are all these things that I got to do because I decided to take this crazy job in Leiden in the Netherlands. So, yeah, I think that was the hardest thing. But I tried to make it. Now it sounds so pat, doesn't it? Oh, yes. Well, it was a learning experience and I made the most of it. But at the time, it wasn't like that at all. It took several years before I could look back at it and see the good, because at the time it just felt awful.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So the lesson there is, no matter how bad it looks, in a couple of years' time, you're going to laugh. And this is what I tell them. I tell this to the PhD students who are writing up. They're like, I'm never going to get my PhD. And I've been writing for 2 years. And, you know, you're going to look back and laugh at this. I swear. You don't think so now, but you will. Yeah. This will be a dream.
Yeah, I completely agree on this. Have you struggled with a particular fear during your career that you would like to share with us?
I think my biggest fear is imposter syndrome. And maybe this is a bit of a boring answer because most women, maybe everybody, feels that they don't actually deserve what they have. I mean, becoming a professor, to me, I still have days when people use my title and I think, who's that? I feel like I don't deserve it. Or I feel like, how could somebody with such a crazy career path and a distinct lack of science and nature papers, you know, be a professor? How could I be a professor? How could anyone take me seriously as a scientist? And it's so hard because I know that's not true. I know I have a really good team. I'm doing really good work. I've got great collaborations. People want to collaborate with me. But in the back of my mind is this little voice saying you're not good enough and everybody knows you're a fraud. And I don't know how that we as scientists, maybe as particularly as female scientists, can overcome this little voice. It's always there somewhere.
But you don't have that. You don't have that as an author, right? You're a published author.
I do.
There's no cheating. There was no imposter. No one else could have done it.
No, I do because, you know, my publishers are not big publishers. I'm not a best-selling author. You know, I shifted a few thousand copies, which is way more than average. But, you know, my books are not advertised on the sides of buses. When you go into an airport, you cannot see my books with raised metallic letters. I'm not a successful writer. I've managed to publish 3 novels. So that's the little voice saying, you know, well.
That's you. Okay.
So you can't get away from it. Well, I can't get away from it. And I don't know how to help my trainees get over that because many of them feel the same. And it's just so hard.
So if you could be one of the characters from one of your own books, which one would it be and why?
It's probably the protagonist of my third novel. The one I mentioned was the person I wrote to be what I am not. Mm-hmm. Highly successful, publishing in great journals, you know.
Papers on the side of buses.
Exactly. Top of the field. Yeah, I'm not that person, but it was fun to imagine that I might be one day. And when I wrote that character, I thought I would never go back into academia. So I was writing that I started writing that novel when I was unemployed in Amsterdam. So I really thought it would never happen. So the fact that I've now become a professor is quite funny because that was the thing that I was never going to be. You know, at least that came true.
When you write about, so you hear writers say that they don't know where the novel is going to go. Do you really have that? Do you discover with the characters or not?
Well, there's a little bit of that, but mostly I have to map it out. Yeah, you have to have the overall. There has to be a premise with a twist, right? There has mm-hmm. to be something. And then you need a framework and, you know, you write chapters and then you read it through and you realize something's missing. Like this character came out of nowhere. I need to insert a chapter explaining why this character would have done this. And then here I need to reorder this because it didn't work. So there's the overarching premise. I do map things out, like with pictures, mind maps and things. But it's flexible in that there is absolutely this discovery that happens. Crazy things occur to you from nowhere, like flashes of inspiration that I don't understand. And I cannot, I can't control it. So things occur to me and sort of brilliant ideas. Oh, actually, if you think about it, X and Y are linked because of this, and I can just tie them together like that. But I don't know where these ideas come from.
Does that parallel a eureka moment in the lab when you suddenly realize that?
I don't think so, because I really feel like lab work is 9/10 sort of just grit. You know, you have a hypothesis and then you set about to prove it. And I've never really had one of those. I think because what I work on is pretty much, you know, discovery based, in that first you look and see what's happening and then you work out why. But I don't know how many scientists really have big eureka moments. I have little micro eureka moments. Oh, actually, if we look at it like this, it might work, or ooh, maybe that's happening. But it's not like one of these, you know, apple falling on my head, mm-hmm. like Newton. That's never happened to me. And maybe, I don't know if that happens to many people, to be honest.
And maybe there is only a micro eureka, stuff like that. I don't know if this exists.
A small cherry instead of a whole apple.
So what advice would you give to yourself if you met yourself 20 years ago?
I would say don't listen to all those people who are telling you that you can't do it. There were so many people like that. Just don't listen to them. Hear them out, nod politely, and then just walk away and ignore everything they've just told you.
Go back to the cocktail party.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think it really is so many people they have good intentions and they think they're being tough love. You know, they're trying to tell you to leave what you love because they don't think you're cut out for it. But if you don't believe that's true, just ignore them. That's what I would tell myself. If I had done that sooner, I think I would have gotten to where I am quicker. But on the other hand, if I'd gotten to where I am more quickly, I wouldn't have had all the weird and interesting sidetracks. So maybe in the end, it was all for the best.
Great. We are arriving at the end of this podcast. It's time for us to start wrapping up. Can you share with us where can people find out more about you?
Well, I've got a website, jennyrohn.com, which describes my novels, my scientific research. You can find me on Twitter at jennyrohn, Instagram. I can't remember my Instagram handle. Oh, that's terrible. And
we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, thank you. I've only recently started Instagram. I was told it was more friendly than Twitter. And I use it exclusively to take photos of beautiful scenery. And I don't talk much about science there. I have a blog. And my blog, Mind the Gap, which I rarely write in these days. But you can find it all on my website.
Great. So it's been great talking to you, Jenny. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Any closing remarks?
I think we've covered everything. What do you think? Have we left anything out?
That's great.
I think we're good. We're going to go and read your novels and listen out for number four. There will be a number four.
I hope so. I hope so. I just have to I may have to abandon my current attempts and start fresh on something else. But yes, hopefully one day.
Thank you very much for all your time, and thanks for being so honest and sharing all these different things. That was great.
It was really nice talking to you. I don't do this so much anymore, and it's nice to just rattle on. Such nice people.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for your time. So that's it for this episode. Thank you for joining us at The Lonely Pipette.
We hope that you learned something new, that something resonated with your own experiences,
or that you just enjoyed the science.
Let us know your thoughts on Twitter at LonelyPipette, and please share it with your friends in the lab. If you want to join our community, you can subscribe to the Lonely Pipette mailing list or mail us by following the link available on our Twitter profile. You will receive the next episodes directly in your mailbox. How cool is that?
Stay tuned for the next show, and remember, you might feel like a lonely pipette, but it doesn't mean you're alone. Tips from the Lonely Pipette can help you to do better science.
A bientôt!
A bientôt!